Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. Four, three, two, and one. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and alongside me today, we have Gabe Rissman, co-founder and president of YourStake.org. Gabe, my man, thanks for coming on the program today.
Of course, Kevin. Thanks for having me. Very excited for today.
Wonderful. Now, before we dive in, just a quick message for Real Leaders and all of the members out there listening to this. Come on over to Real Leaders Unite February 5 through 7. If you're an impact CEO looking to increase capital sources, connections, experience to help you navigate 2024, and you want to just surround yourself around people who can speak your language, come on over to Real Leaders Unite February 5 through 7 to join the other members and go deep together. Once again, that's Real Leaders Unite, February 5 through 7. Just go online to realleaders.com to get more information and join the community for impact. Today, back to the interview. Gabe, I'm looking at your face right now. You seem probably same age as I am, maybe not, maybe a little bit older than I am. I mean, it's incredible to get a young CEO on the program. Do you mind if I ask, like, how old you are right now?
29
years old. Okay, I'm 28.
How about you?
I'm 28, impressive. So it's always fascinating just when I get, you know, someone, you know, young who's doing incredible things, gaining this experience at this age. Anytime I get someone like that, I want to go to like the founder story. So when I ask you that, like, how did this all come about? How do you answer that question?
Yeah, I say, do you want the long story or the medium story or the short story?
Give me the long story.
All right. Well, maybe I'll start with a little bit of medium and then we can go into rabbit holes and tangents,
sure,
which is always more fun. So the way that I got started was as a student activist in college. Mm-hmm. I met my co-founder in 2012 when we were working together as part of the Yale Student Environmental Coalition. And we were working and campaigning to try to get the university endowment to make its investments more responsible and make it better aligned with the values of the university. And so there were a bunch of different campaigns going on and we played a role in all different parts. We were looking at how solar panels could be added to the campus from an actual, hey, how does the university look at its own operation standpoint? We also looked at the endowment and did a lot of research on impact investing, essentially, and the best way that that could be incorporated into the Yale endowment. And that's how we got our start. It was back in 2012, actually. This was the big campaign that was going on in college campuses and on the environmental side. And it was something that had a whole bunch of different tentacles and branches. And that was our focus, was how the university endowment could focus more on impact investing across all of its portfolio. And we realized that there were a lot of challenges that existed in doing that, and that it was a broader problem. It wasn't just the university endowment. There was a huge lack of data. There was a huge lack of understanding of what it even means to invest with impact and what creates impact and how to align with your values as an organization. And when my co-founder and I graduated, we ended up doing a big research paper on what actually does create the most impact in impact investing and surveyed a whole bunch of financial advisors, wealth managers that were helping individuals and institutions with this question on the day-to-day. And we found that there was a huge lack of data, and not just that, but there were a lot of data points out there that were really hard to understand. There were a lot of data points out there that were really hard to communicate and tell a story around. And it was really hard to use those data points as part of a portfolio analysis software, which is something that wealth managers are living in day to day, right? Instead of just a big spreadsheet dump, that's not super helpful. How do I actually make this a useful tool? So my co-founder and I both had experiences in data science. I did computational astrophysics. My co-founder was in econometrics. And we built our own database as well as a set of software tools to be able to analyze portfolios, assess what financial advisors' clients actually care about. Is it human rights that you really want to focus on? Is it faith alignment? Is it the environment, whatever it might be, or combinations? And then be able to evaluate and build better portfolios that are better values aligned, and build portfolios and report on the impact of those portfolios. Now, the last big update that's come, I used to say this year, in 2023, now it's 2024. The last big update is our whole team is very focused on data science and had a lot of artificial intelligence background. We saw a huge step forward in AI technologies that happened at the end of 2022 and in 2023. And we realized there was a ton of potential to be able to help scale personalized investing and also just provide better tools for our customer base in general. So what we're doing right now is essentially providing the full portfolio analytics suite of solutions that a financial advisor needs, powered by artificial intelligence technology, with the values alignment and personalization as just a key component of the full solution. So that's the story for how we're here now.
I get it. It makes sense. This is the space I'm in. And I commend you for what you're doing and the impact that could have, this B2B software solution for financial advisors to give them a portfolio lens, if you will, of kind of how their investments are stacking up, what the impact is, and from the companies that they're investing in. Now, that takes a lot of time to put together. To analyze, how a $100,000 investment in Apple can, remove, carbon out of the planet. There's just so many different intricate things. Like, how does one aggregate all that information and decide, like, this is actually what the impact is? Like, walk me through that challenging process.
Sure. So a lot of it is different from what is classically seen in the industry. So a lot of the industry is very focused on scoring. You have analysts that are looking at the environmental, as an example, profile of Apple and saying, hey, I'll give this a AAA rating or an 8 out of 10 or whatever it might be. And there's a whole bunch of research to back it up, and they'll do that across industries. But a lot of times what you're not seeing is that direct, well, what are the greenhouse gas emissions, or what's the water consumption profile, or what's the involvement in human rights in the supply chain? And is there, especially with, like, there's a ton of issues in supply chain human rights with a lot of rare earth materials, and a lot of times the clean energy industry is wrapped up in that. So that data isn't often obviously available because it's wrapped up in a score. So what we do is we go out and try to find publicly available data sources. We prefer government agencies like the EPA, for example, and similar ones around the world. Companies are mandated to disclose a particular methodology for all of their information. So it's apples to apples comparisons. So we're getting from government data sources. We're getting from regulatory filings, like when you file your 10K annual report. We're pulling from academic sources, and we're pulling from nonprofits. And then what we're doing is we are mapping all that data to the portfolio and then being able to display that information in helpful ways. So we're not creating the data points. We're pulling the data points in from all these different sources and then making it easy to be able to see everything all in one place.
Got it. And just for the audience listening out there, you mentioned, water consumption and being one, let's say a CO2 emissions would be another, human supply chains, something removed, bottles removed, plastic bottles removed. So let's say,
yep.
Could you maybe provide just a clear example for our audience listening to this to get a better understanding of what that interface looks like? Obviously, this is just audio.
Sure. Yeah. So you can see all of the metrics for your portfolio, and you're able to compare that to a benchmark or to, hey, maybe I should invest in this other portfolio as well. So a lot of times it's a side-by-side comparison. And then what you were talking about, bottles removed and all those different things, we call those our metaphor metrics. So if you load up a portfolio, I'll give an example actually with one of our favorite or a fan favorite metric is chicken slaughtered. If you own 1% of Tyson Foods, for example, then as a 1% owner, you're 1% responsible for all of their activities, everything that they do. So if they are slaughtering 100 billion chickens, which the number isn't exactly that, it's just an easy number to work with, then as a 1% owner, you would be responsible for 1 billion chickens slaughtered out of that 100 billion. And then same thing with water consumption. If a company is consuming 100 billion gallons of water and you're a 1% owner, you're responsible for 1% of that consumption. We're not saying that you're causing the impact. It's not a causal thing. It's just like a footprint, essentially. It's from the perspective of responsibility. So we can convert basically the impact profile of your investments into the animal welfare metrics, into gallons of water used, into asthma attacks from toxic air pollution, homes powered by clean energy. And there's a bunch of different metrics that are out there. We have about 25 to 30 of what we call these metaphor metrics, which help you get a better sense of what's really going on within the portfolio in more understandable terms.
And for financial advisors listening out there, you know, there, I guess in my space, Gabe, like there are so many ultra high net worth impact investors who, mm-hmm. you know, want to know more than what their money's going toward. Like they everything is so opaque, especially when you're young. You know, you want to just get the most maximum shareholder return, and then you start to ask yourself questions: is what is my money going toward? What is the legacy I want to leave? And if you're a financial planner and you don't have answers to those questions, you're going to lose a lot of access to those high net worth individuals who want to make impact investing. So back to the origin story. I want to get too carried away with the how. Let's continue to go into with the why. So you have the idea. Tell me a little bit more about those early stages. Like, how would you break down, Gabe, like those early stages from idea to growth?
Sure. Well, it started with a lot of ideas. And luckily, I think I don't know if it was the right approach, but we took an approach that we're continuing to take today, which was fast iteration. And assuming that we don't have the answers, but our customers do have the answers. So we spent a lot of time watching videos, reading articles, talking to mentors, trying to figure out the best way to do really good customer development interviews. And we were able to identify people that had this problem of not being able to communicate or understand the impact of their investments, and then ask them as many questions as we could without having a solution in mind. That I think was the biggest thing, just really tried to understand their problem and their pain point. And then from there, we tried to build solutions and put it in front of them, and then tried to see if there was a willingness to pay for that solution. So it was asking a lot of questions and really trying to understand what the problems are was the way that we got to where we are now. And it went through a bunch of iterations to be able to settle on that. I'd also say that's something that we do all the time. So every single call that we have with one of our clients, which we're doing all day long, we're always asking, hey, what's working well? What could be improved? And also, just tell me about your life and your practice and what are the challenges that you face generally? And that's actually what led to a bunch of innovations on the artificial intelligence side, is people saying, oh man, like, I just got a big document and I need to type all of the information into a spreadsheet from this document. And it's really annoying. And we just heard that enough times that we thought, hey, maybe we can provide some solutions to that problem as well, even if it's not directly related to what we were already doing. And that type of process led us to build out a much more general purpose suite of tools that we think is really, really powerful from an impact standpoint, because it makes our product more accessible and more relevant to all advisors instead of just advisors that are very focused on the impact category. If we're just providing tools that save you time with manual entry, that's something that anyone would want to use. And hey, look, there's this impact side right here that you would otherwise not see if you're using any other general purpose tool. So we see our mechanism for helping to scale impact is just providing a better experience for general wealth management purposes. And oh, by the way, here you go. When you have your values-based client, you just click a button and it's right there, really easy and expertly done as well. So that was, again, part of that iteration process too.
It makes a lot of sense. It seems like you're very like customer focused. You know, you've built this mm-hmm. platform based on the iterations and feedback from, you know, potential customers and your mentors and customers. But you know, as they say, right? Yeah, you build it, it doesn't mean they'll come, right? You know, tell me a little bit more about your sales challenges. How are you doing in sales? What were some of those early roadblocks you kind of ran into?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you a more recent set of roadblocks, which was, the history of the values-based investing movement, it was pretty minimal, basically from the 1960s until the mid-2000s, where there was a lot of people that didn't want to invest in, for example, apartheid South Africa, and there are other divestment movements. You want to avoid tobacco, alcohol, gambling. A lot of it was driven by faith-based investors. And I would say around 2012, things started to really pick up when there started to be a lot of attention around particularly how climate change integrates into investments. And then that continued to grow. And around 2020, DEI started to be a huge question that people are asking about their investments as well. And then human rights and a lot of avoiding the sin stocks, all those different things were already part of these questions and started to grow too. So there was a tremendous growth in values-based investing, particularly in 2020 and then 2021. And in 2022, there was a lot of pushback. There was pushback from multiple angles as well. There was some regulatory pushback where a lot of investment managers were really trying to take advantage of this trend and label everything as values aligned. And then the SEC started looking into things, and same with other regulatory agencies around the world, saying, hold on, is this really going through a rigorous process of the values alignment, or are you just kind of using it for branding? So there was that kind of pushback. And then there was pushback from a political perspective as well, saying, hey, these aren't my values. Because a lot of the growth around this was with the term ESG. And ESG was kind of a one-size-fits-all. These are the issues that an analyst deems as important. And a lot of people were saying, these aren't my values. This isn't what I'm looking for. So there was a big speed bump in 2022 and early 2023 around values-based investing. We think our solution actually, we really tried to design it to avoid those problems even before those problems popped up. Instead of being one-size-fits-all, we allowed for a survey for financial advisors to figure out what their clients cared about, and then just mapped that to the relevant data points instead of us kind of determining this data point matters and this one doesn't. But despite that, there was just a lot of fear and confusion surrounding the whole field that came out of this kind of cultural moment where there was pushback from regulatory bodies and from a political perspective at the same time. So that actually was very challenging for us and several others in our industry. I do think that speed bump, we're now starting to get to the other side of that, where a lot of terminology is being cleared up and a lot more understanding is being brought to the field. But we also, in that time, that's where the customer development process was really helpful for us as well, because we were always asking questions throughout and trying to understand what people need, how we can best serve our advisors, and what other products that we could build to be able to do that best.
That makes a lot of sense. And I really like how you gave like the audience a historical perspective. I mean, there's a few things I even learned in there too, and it's totally right. I mean, it really did start out this like faith-based movement to avoid tobacco and alcohol and things that didn't align with their values. And it's kind of, it's like still like trying to take form. I don't want to say it's new though, because it's definitely not. But yeah, of course, you know, recent, I think like recently, you know, Tennessee, you know, is filing a lawsuit against BlackRock. BlackRock's obviously facing a lot of laid back. They just laid off a ton of employees in their ESG department. So it's interesting just to see how this kind of all lays out. But I really like your objective approach of regardless of your values, whether they're right or wrong, here's the hard data. Just speaking from like a growth perspective, like what has been kind of your strategy to reach out to the financial advisors to make sure that this is a tool that they can actually use?
A lot of it is conferences. At the beginning. I mean, We didn't obviously have a network of financial advisors at the very beginning, and we went to a lot of aligned industry conferences. So that was a huge thing for us. And we still often go to a number of different conferences every year where you can meet a bunch of financial advisors and have a lot of those conversations really quickly and rapidly. But that was something that we had to do at the beginning. More recently, we've been really leaning into community sessions, office hours, talking to networks of advisors and kind of allowing the opportunity, offering check-ins for everyone to help walk them through the tool and updates and hear their thoughts. We really, really, really try to create the space for anyone to be able to provide feedback, talk to other power users of the tool and figure out best practices and share them together. We learn from how people are using things, right? So that's a big thing that we do right now, is just try to facilitate ways for people to share feedback and thoughts with us while also getting a lot of value out of that, so that it's worth their time.
Yeah, I would anticipate that would be, or I guess imagine that would be incredibly valuable, because you're learning like firsthand experience while also like being able to take that back, build those relationships, but also take that back to the software. I think it's great what you're doing. I'm just more curious from like a leadership lens now, like what are some of the challenges like you're currently running into as a leader? I mean, I doubt you have any time. I bet there's some issues going on internally, but you know, you got to stay focused. You've got to make decisions. You got to help grow the company. I mean, this is not only you know, just a business. This is also part of your life. What are some of the current challenges like you're going through?
Let's see. Well, I think I'll have to reassess that, because I think we just went through a really interesting time in our company's history where there were a lot of challenges that are going to be different from the ones that I'm facing right now. So maybe I'll share a little bit of both. The big challenge that we just faced and spent a lot of time on and really had to overcome was introducing this new set of AI tools for financial advisors that were general purpose. So all of our branding was fully about values aligned investing, and that's still a core part of what we do. But like I mentioned before, a lot of advisors are now signing up for Your Stake just for the general purpose solutions, and being able to figure out the new branding and new sales strategy. And we kind of had to rethink almost everything about what we do and why, and challenge all of our assumptions. And I would say that we're now kind of through that particular challenge, and now our challenge is around scaling and getting distribution. We feel like we have a really, really solid product. We're always trying to improve that product, but that's something that we understand very well, and we have that great feedback cycle. So we have a roadmap that we're super confident about. And now two things, but they're fun challenges. One is the distribution challenge of just how do we get the word out there as much as possible? And then the other one is, I think that artificial intelligence, particularly with wealth management, has so much potential to create change. And there's going to be a big reshuffling in the wealth tech environment, the tools for financial advisors. And I think a lot of financial advisors are going to also shift a lot of their day-to-day where a lot of the stuff that they do right now, manual entry, putting together certain plans, I think a lot of the what you might call grunt work is going to be shifted onto technology, and financial advisors are going to be much more focused on the relationship, custom solutions, providing more value, offering more services. I think that this particular industry is changing very, very fast. And just staying on top of that is probably going to be the big challenge going forward, and also helping to drive that forwards. So I think we're well positioned based off of our culture of that feedback. But I think that there's going to be a lot of disruption and a lot of change over the next couple of years caused by artificial intelligence, as well as caused by shifting like other macro factors, right? There's a lot of the business model for financial advisors has been changing over the years. A lot of the value they provided used to be just being a good stock picker, and now it's more on financial planning. And then as there's more competition, there's, I'm getting a little bit technical now, but there's a lot of like pressure to reduce your fees. And then a lot of advisors, instead of wanting to reduce fees, are providing more value and providing more services. I think technology is really creating a lot of change already. We are already on a trend of kind of shifting what it means to be a financial advisor. And then AI is just accelerating that and really lighting a fire under that. So it's fun. It's really exciting. I think that the customer, the consumer, at the end of the day, is going to benefit a ton from just being better served by their financial advisor and having better financial outcomes because of that. But for financial advisors, there's a lot of change that's going to be happening, and it'll be challenging for everyone in the industry to figure out where everything's going to shake out.
Well, Gabe, I appreciate you sharing that. And one of the questions I'd love to just dive into, if I may, just like what you said, we had to challenge a lot of assumptions. What assumptions are you talking about? Maybe help share that process, because I think a lot of leaders are going through that as well.
Yeah. I think we created a lot of assumptions around really everything, right? Our whole business was built, and over the years, you pick things up, you realize these are the strategies that work, these are the ones that don't. From as simple as doing webinars versus doing conferences versus should you meet clients in person, should you have Zoom calls, can we operate with our team in better ways as we're remote? There's so many different things. And we really went back and looked through everything and tried to see how we can be more effective. Let me think of those assumptions, though. I think the biggest assumption that we had, which we challenged, and I'm really glad we did, we assumed that financial advisors that already have their core tools are pretty set in stone with those core tools. And we would be able to be best positioned by creating an additional tool for values-based investing that was kind of siloed, that was really, really deep in values-based investing. And people would do their other stuff on some other platform, and they would do their values-based investing work on your stake. And the assumption that I'm really glad that we challenged, I think, was incorrect. And what we've seen is that a lot of financial advisors are looking to consolidate a lot of their tech. They're looking for solutions that are a bit more all-in-one. And what they're really happy about is being able to do their risk analysis, their returns analysis, diversification, concentration, like everything that they need to do on one platform that also has values as a part of it. So that's really directed our product development, is now we already had the data and the capabilities to do it. We were just focusing on being a really, really strong one focused product. And now that we're broadening out, I think that's been a really successful shift in assumption for us.
You're broadening out, but you're also being like laser focused on what the market's at, like telling you, you know? And so I think that's like, I appreciate you sharing that, because I really think that that's what's happening right now in the impact arena is, you know, the companies that are really listening to their customers are having to challenge the assumption of impact first. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, in a challenging market, this is what happens. And so I appreciate you just sharing that and just knowing that, you know, it's not just us that's going through it too, right? Other companies are adapting, changing. And of course, it's not just that in your world. It's a ton of forces. AI, I mean, quantum computing next. I mean, it's all coming. Yeah. And we got to adapt to make sure that the market gets addressed. I did have a cool question. I just want to kind of lean into a little bit more the distribution challenge, just because, mm-hmm. you know, that's any scaling company's challenges, right? Like that's what you run into, whether it's awareness, whether it's, you know, I don't know, do you have an outbound strategy, inbound strategy? Like what kind of has been effective for you? Where do you think you're going more toward? I know like a lot of tech industry is going actually a lot more outbound now. Mm-hmm. What's kind of your focus?
Sure. Well, I think what's been most effective has been having an awesome team. So quick shout out if you guys are listening, but yeah, our sales and marketing team has been really great at challenging assumptions and experimenting and doing everything that needs to happen to be able to figure out what to do. We have been doing more outbound for sure. I think conferences were really tricky during COVID, but continue to be a really, really strong source of success. Social media, LinkedIn. And we are starting to see that as we're trying to play a very big multi-channel, just get our name out there in a lot of different ways, people are starting to find us, which is really nice. And people have started signing up for demos without necessarily us having direct contact with them, just through finding our materials or seeing information from us. In a lot of different places. So I'm actually not the architect of that strategy, so I can't speak to too many of the details, but I really trust the people that are implementing it and creating it.
That's a great value to have. Just out of curiosity, like how do you separate the balance of what the company needs? Are you like, how do you explain and describe to your team even like your responsibilities, maybe as opposed to a co-founder or a CEO?
Sure. It shifts a lot of times, actually. So usually I try to fill what's needed. In other times, and it depends on how big the team is too. My co-founder has oftentimes led things like the hiring and the fundraising, and I've been very product focused and sales and customer support. I actually really love doing customer support. And maybe that's why we're very feedback focused. It's just something that I think is important and enjoy doing myself. But yeah, and it depends on like the skill sets of our team. So part of this shift in what our product strategy was also led to a shift in responsibilities. And I think what we hired for and selected for was people that were comfortable and happy being flexible and were more generalists and had a lot of skill sets. So that has been really, really helpful.
I like that. Yeah. And so many lessons learned. I'm just like out of curiosity, like where do you go for an outlet, or do you have a mentor you go to? Do you have a group you're involved with? What's been helpful for you to kind of get that experience as you navigate these delicate issues?
One of our early investors is a really strong mentor. And then we do talk to a lot of our investors. I think that my co-founder oftentimes, that doesn't make sense what I was about to say. I was going to say my co-founder like deals with challenges that are more mentorable, for example, interacting with investors. But I think that you can have plenty of mentorship on designing product and running a team. I think that we found a lot of success, not just talking to people as mentors, but watching things like Startup School from Y Combinator, or just reading articles and watching YouTube videos. So I think there are certain custom things that require a discussion with a mentor. And then there's a lot of general running a team and building a product, which I probably more focus on things where more generalized advice is still really useful and helpful. So I think I probably rely more on that.
Got it. No, thanks for sharing. And I ask because I'm more curious, like, hey, like, what are you, like, what's been helpful for you? Mm-hmm. When I say the term work-life balance, the phrase work-life balance, what pops into your mind?
I think it's important to create a culture where people feel like they're able to achieve that on the team. I don't know if I personally, well, I don't personally achieve that, but I
do you want to achieve that?
I think that I would be, and I always have been, happy trading that off for impact potential. If I didn't think that we were doing good for the world, I would care a lot more about work-life balance. But it matters less to me personally because I believe so much in what we're doing. But I do think that, like, I'm not trying to set an example for the culture for the team. I think that we try very hard to create a really positive culture where people are not overworked or anything like that. And I'm proud of, like, the way that we interact and the friendliness. But yeah, I myself am usually working.
Would you describe your work ethic as a passion or an addiction, or neither?
Passion. Yeah, definitely.
When you think about, like, your success, like, or just success itself, like, have you ever thought about defining that or thinking about what that looks like to you?
Yeah, I've tried defining it, but every time I try to define it, the world changes. So I'm less into defining it now, which is funny because we do impact measurement as part of our product. But for my own personal impact, like, I have general guidelines, but I think it's more of a feeling for me, actually.
How do you, just out of curiosity, how do you go about, like, prioritizing your day?
I a lot of times it's done through check-ins with the team. Mm-hmm. I mean, my own structure is, like, yeah, I have, I guess, a project management function, but our team is really rigorous about setting a priority list and figuring out who needs to work on what. So that's not, it used to be a big challenge, but I think we have a pretty good solution for that. And it's kind of just go down the list.
Right. No, absolutely. No, I get it. Well, yeah, I appreciate you just taking the time to be with us today. Two more questions I got for you. One is just because we are on kind of the topic of impact. You know, you said it's kind of working itself out. It's still yet to be clearly defined. Like, just how do you define impact in a business sense?
Sure. Personal impact or, like, the impact of a company?
Impact of a company.
Sure. I do think that's better defined. I was saying, I think by personal impact, it's harder to define, but I do think that the impact of a company, well, at least a public company. I think for a lot of smaller companies in the VC private equity stage, like, a lot of guidance that I've heard. So, sorry, taking a step back, we really focus on impact measurement for public equity, public debt, publicly traded securities, essentially. What I've heard from the private side is that a lot of times, what matters more than measurable metrics is, like, the impact thesis of the company. What are they actually doing? What product are they building? What's the impact of that product? Whereas for public companies, a lot of times it's more focused on the impact of the operations. And the impact of the product is still really important, but for smaller companies, the operations are just changing so much, and where positive potential can come from a lot of times is just, are you building a product that solves really important challenges for people and the planet? Now, defining impact for public companies, there's a ton of information out there. And I think what it really comes down to is your definition of impact. So there are certain people where they only care about a couple things. Their mom died of lung cancer, and their definition of impact is not supporting tobacco companies. For other people, their mom died of lung cancer, and their definition of impact is trying to invest in companies that are creating alternatives or that are trying to do corporate lobbying or things like that to provide safer public health outcomes. Or there's a lot of different ways that people want to interact with things. My own personal definition of corporate impact focuses a lot on Well, I would say my own personal definition of investor impact focuses a lot on the concept of additionality, which I maybe to define that for the audience in my own words is, what are you doing that otherwise would not have happened from a positive impact perspective? So when I look at investing in public markets, a lot of times what I'm looking at is the shareholder advocacy that's being done by a fund manager or by a financial advisor to try to encourage companies to improve their positive impact on the world. And that, I think, is where a lot of the real impact comes from an investor's perspective in the public markets. I'm less of an expert in the private market, so I'll leave that to someone else.
Let's say it's very similar. I mean, I think the private markets at the end of the day is just transforming lives through business. You know, are you providing something that otherwise wouldn't be there, which is very similar to your concept of additionality. Sure. So I think it's very, very similar, but, you know, it's different, right? Like, I mean, if you're in a public corporation, I mean, you have a legal duty to maximize shareholder value, or in private markets, you don't. Hey, look, this has been an awesome discussion. I wish we had more time. Time just flew by today. I can't believe we're already kind of at that hour mark. We'll love to kind of dive in further, Gabe, but let's just bring this home for now. In all of this, what is your definition of a real leader?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that makes someone a real leader is empowering the team. And I think that's the number one thing. A real leader is someone that can encourage their team to be passionate and love what they're doing. And I think I do an okay job. I have a lot of room to grow. But that is something that I think about all the time whenever I'm thinking about leadership when it applies to my own personal perspective. I'd actually love to hear, you've done hundreds of these, right? I really want to know what your definition of a real leader is. I don't know if you're able to share or at least some cool thoughts that you've heard over the years.
Oh man. It's tough. There's just so many. I think to me, increasingly real to me is kind of what is imperfect. And that's kind of like a philosophical way to look at it, I guess. But I think that real leader is really just being imperfect and just owning, you know, dissolving that ego, owning their mistakes, being themselves and just keeping it real. Leadership, though, I think is a different question. I think leadership, it could be empowering someone, right? It could be empowering someone by listening better, right? I mean, that's a common question we have. It could be creating a decentralized organization. I think a leader is, simply put, someone who can connect with a bunch of different people in a bunch of different ways. And if enough people are connected, inherently, you just have a movement. And that movement's really what a leader does. They lead that movement through doing that. And who knows how they do it? Your way of connecting people might be empowering them, you know? And I just think it's different for everybody. There's no right answer. So it's kind of it's an interesting question to ask at the end, because it really will never be defined, I think, personally. Yeah. But I appreciate you asking, and I absolutely love the answer you provided of empowering the team. So with that being said, for Gabe Brisbane, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, empower others, and always keep it real. Thank you, Gabe.
Thanks so much, Kevin. This is really fun.
Hey, real leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.